Blog Talk Radio.
So good to be back, and I am excited about my next guest because I've written a couple of books on finance, and I've been in the financial area for like 30 years or more, and the stuff that this gentleman is going to talk about has me excited. His name is Ted McLimon, and he's the author of, he has three books, but the one that we're going to be talking about today as well is going to be called Discover Your Money Temperament, A Common Sense Guide to Financial Security. Ted is an entrepreneur, business owner, author, speaker, trainer, United States Marine Corps retired, Lieutenant Colonel, and an Ironman All-World AIDS Group triathlete. He has a BA in Social Relations, an MA in Masters in Public Administration, an MS in Instructional and Performance Technology. He's the founder of Apex Behavioral Financial Group, and he's authored three books on behavioral finance, and he created Quick Scan Money Temperament Assessment. So we're so excited to have Ted McLimon on. Good evening, sir. How are you doing this evening?
It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, great. Well, first of all, a triathlete. Now, I'm looking at your picture. You're not a young guy. You're out there still doing it, huh?
I have throttled back a little bit, but my last full triathlon, which is the 140.6, I did that for my 65th birthday.
Wow. So, well, 146, what does that mean?
That means it's a 2.5 mile swim, 112 okay. mile bike ride, and then a 26.2 mile run.
Wow. I'm not going to even ask you how you train for something like that. I mean, that's like Olympic level kind of stuff. But that kind of belies all the things you've been accomplished. You're a very driven man from all the things that you've done, you know. So I definitely understand that. Now I want to dive right in because you know I've written a couple of books on personal finance, but never have I heard anybody talk about the behavioral part of money. So I think that's an important part of what we need to discuss. So in your book, you say something that money is hard for people. Explain that. Why is that?
Well, let me just give you a little background on how I got to this point. I did 21 years in the Marine Corps, and I saw every kind of money behavior problem you could have, and that was one of my jobs as a young officer, to fix young Marines from doing really stupid things with money. It caused behavioral problems, retention problems, discipline, substance abuse, et cetera, et cetera. I've got my first master's degree, and my payback was teaching economics at the Naval Academy. And there I found it took really smart young people to do really dumb things with money. And we started looking at the relationship because they were losing commissions, they were doing some really crazy things, and we had to fix something. And what I was finding is what I was teaching in the classroom, which is classic traditional economics and personal finance, which assumed we're all rational with complete information and then, you know, we're capable of doing the right thing with money if you have enough facts. They were excellent in the classroom, but just abysmal out in the real world. Built the Marine Corps' financial management program and was a commander of the schoolhouse for a while, and then did a tour of the Secretary of the Navy, working with the House and the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Secretary of the Navy for financial management. And there I learned that the policymakers are just as crazy as everybody else when it comes to money, particularly somebody else's money. Retired, became a financial advisor, fully licensed independent financial advisor, working with clients. It was obvious to me that most of my job was to manage behavior, not money. And it was obvious to me that the industry was more focused on activity, products, and services, and a cookie-cutter approach, and it really didn't fit well, which I saw the distinct behavioral differences in my clients And then with the lead up in 2008, we had a bit of a meltdown then, very similar to what we're doing now. And that's when I really got into the behavioral piece, because I realized I saw what was coming, and I started training or teaching my clients at that time that they needed to behave, manage their behavior, not their money. And that led to my first book, and that was kind of the basis. But what we're finding, and this goes back to my work with not only the Marine Corps dealing with human behavior and decision making, but also my second master's degree in performance technology, that we as humans are wired to do a couple things real well. And it really comes down to staying alive and passing on the genes. Everything after that is kind of, well, secondary. So what we're finding is that our brains, which are eons old from a biological point of view, are really well designed to keep us alive, you know, at the most basic level, let's say in the forest, but they're not real good at navigating the streets of Atlanta and New York City in today's economy. So fundamentally, as humans are just not that good with money. It's not the default. The default is being emotional, being on autopilot, but doing taxes, reading the small print on credit cards, that kind of stuff is not something that comes to us. And that's very different than what I was taught as a financial advisor and economist. And so I said, we've got to sit down and change some of this. So that's how I got here.
And so you figured out that it was more about that the reason that most people are not successful because of their behavior around money. Sort of like the reason they're not successful dieting is because of their behavior around food. Does that make sense? I mean, your relationship with food.
Oh, bingo, bingo, bingo. Yeah. It fascinated me. Now, because I'm an athlete, I knew as an athlete to get in shape that it was more about managing my behavior at a certain level, and that having a coach made a difference, somebody that knew my capabilities, my limitations, what I was good at, what I was not so good at, but more importantly, how I was uniquely wired, which was different from the person on the bicycle next to me. And the point is, with diet and exercise, the end is a goal. How you get there, there are a number of ways to do it. There's not a single best path. It has to be designed for you as an individual. Your biology, your beliefs with regard to diet and exercise, the culture you're in, that makes a big difference. But I find it fascinating that money is one of the few things that we don't take that approach. We kind of assume that you reach the age of majority, which is age 18 in most places, and we kind of say, good luck. You will figure it out. Well, the reality is most people are not figuring it out.
And, you know, and I led an effort years and years ago, you know, and my belief was that no matter what you do, whatever type of degree you have or whatever type of job you have to learn how to manage your money. And none of that is taught in the schools. And so you get
out
a job, it's not taught in the schools. And so we're teaching them how to make a living, but not really to live successfully. And that's why we have people with credit problems, people going into debt, people not being successful managing their money. We have all these programs. And then we have these big corporations, because I'm a firm believer, Ted, is that if you are a bad money manager with a little money, you could head up a corporation, you might be just as bad. You know, in other words, in the things you have a lot of
things. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Does that make sense? If you were not good with little money, and when we talk on the second part, we talk about FUBU Collection founder J. Alexander Martin. What he did with money is going to astound people, but they might understand, you know, why he might have done some of those things. So this is an interesting topic to talk about because it gets down to it. So you say we're not hardwired to work well with money. And one of the things you say in your book is that money choices are always emotional. Explain that.
Yep. Okay. Without getting into the neurology and the biology of how our brains work, I try to keep this really simple. And if this relates to the people that are listening on the podcast, just put your two hands together, two fists, and put them next to each other. That's about the size of your brain. Well, your brain is the most magnificent organ. It does amazing things, and some things incredibly well. But to make it simple, you've got a feeling brain, which is automatic, primitive, reactive, and your default. And you've got this thinking brain that is relatively new. It's focused. It's single purpose. And it's slow and deliberate. Well, we spend most of our time in our feeling brain. Our feeling brain keeps our heart moving, remembers to breathe. It's emotional. And we've got what's called this associative brain, that we have experiences that they register and they're stored in our brain in different places. And when we get to an event in an environment, it recalls those past experiences and creates a picture, and that's our reality. Well, most of that happens automatically. And in spending, most of our spending is emotional, automatic, and unconscious. And here's the example I give you. If you drive to work as a commuter every day, you don't get in the car and make a conscious effort how to get from point A to point B using rational engineering terms. No, you get in the car, and there are days that I would drive to work, and I honestly don't remember how I got there, unless there was a significant event that got my attention. We do the same thing with money.
That's fascinating stuff, because I think that a lot of people, you know, they try to be successful with money, and they just keep. And now during this pandemic, you would think now there's some people out of work, but some people who are working, you would think now would be the time that they get a better grip on their money in terms of their budget and things like that, and how they can cut and all those kinds of things. So now you have a money behavior system, and you have about five things.
Right.
And if we can go through some of those things, he says. One of the things you told me is, what are your money values? Can you share a little bit on that? What do you mean by that?
Well, let me lead up to how I got to the behavior system. The three things that get in our way and conspire against us every time we go buy a car, and that's how you get the extra navigation system, or you spend too much at Starbucks, it really doesn't matter, is our biology, I've already talked about, but our belief set. Our belief set is a function of where we grew up and who we grew up with. And I'm not blaming anybody, but it's by mid-adolescence, by the time you're in middle school, you've got this pretty standard you've got a belief set with regard to money that's hard to change, but it's pretty much who you are. Or to put it another way, think back when you needed a starter jacket, a pair of Jordans, and a lot of hair, you still think that way with regard to money. And then the last piece is our culture. Our culture has an incredible impact on how our belief sets with money, how we interact with money, and what we think is important. And there's a microculture, which is our family and our neighborhood, maybe our school and the teams are with, and our church, and then it goes out to the regional level, and then there's a national that's a little bit more macro. And I've worked with clients from all different countries, and I've toured the world, and there are different cultural elements with regard to money. Well, that's who we are. And what we don't realize is our feeling brain sucks all that stuff in. So when we get into a buying situation, by default, it takes, first, it's our biology, you know, and the default is I want to stay alive. So that's the first thing you think about. You don't think of that happens in your body when you're spending. And there's a little neurohormone that's called dopamine, which is the anticipation drug that makes it really feel good about going in and buying stuff. Then your belief set kicks in. You know, is it okay to spend money, or am I going to save money? And then the culture. I have to have fill in the blanks. Well, once I laid out this problem, and the problem basically is that we as humans just are not really hardwired to do well with money, and all kinds of things conspire against us on a daily basis every time we think about spending. So I wanted to come up with something that was simple, that anybody could follow, that would give them some hope in making better money choices. And I call it the precursor to what we do with the standard financial planning process. And this is the piece that I think the traditional planning process is missing, and it's the behavioral piece. So to go back to what you said, it starts with value. Values are nothing more. I call it money values. Money values are the most important things in life to you, that define your lifestyle, that define your legacy, that define who you are, and they cost money. And if you don't accomplish these things, they're going to cause you emotional pain. I just want to know what that's going to cost. And for most people, it's not stuff. It's taking care of the family. It's leaving something to the community. It's being a better person. Well, then the kicker is, I say, okay, that's fine. Now show me your calendar and your checkbook, and I'll tell you what your values really are. And I don't care what they are. It might be eating out, buying clothes, having cars, playing golf. That's not the point. The point is you can have both of those values, to leave a large legacy to your church or play golf every weekend. But the problem is you probably can't do both.
What I was going to say is that I thought about an incident that happened when I was in church, and I remember, you know, I lost my checkbook, and I was frantically looking around for my checkbook. This is back in the day when people actually did check registers.
Yeah, knew what a checkbook was.
Right. So, and the pastor found my checkbook and he gave it to me. Boy, I started saying, wow, did he look through my checkbook and see how I was spending my money? You know, because as you have
shared,
that you look at somebody's check register, you see what they really value, you know.
And that's really important thing to come
to some type of decision about, to know what that is, because a lot of people just don't know. They may have an indication of what it is, but they may not fully understand it, you know, in that case.
Right, and then if I go back to remember that feeling brain, you're spending most of your time and most of your money on autopilot. You're not even consciously registering. You just kind of get in the groove. Well, everybody goes eats out on Wednesday night, so I go there. Everybody does this. I've got to live in this neighborhood. So it's very easy to get into this pattern where your professed values are not aligned with your emotional values. And you can't fool yourself. It's going to happen. And here's the other point. I don't judge. I don't care if you want to, if you, as a financial advisor, if you really wanted to play golf three times a week and be a member of the best clubs in town, I can show you how to do that. But don't complain later when you don't have that legacy to the church. And when I sat down and worked with clients, it was not unusual to have somebody in tears for a few minutes and look at each other and say, I did not realize that was that important to you. And that's what I mean. We never have that conversation. We always talk about goals. Goals are fine, but goals are different stuff. Stuff that's different than I call big V values. Big V values are what define you. Stuff is stuff you have. And it usually depreciates in value.
Another part of your money behavior system is money temperament. So how is that different from money values, your money temperament? Explain that.
Money values are the foundation. They define who you are at the most emotional essence of subconsciousness. Money temperament is simply how you naturally feel and think about money. It's how you are wired. And it's a function of your natural biology, how you are wired biologically, and you're going to do certain things just to stay alive, and that's who you are, and it's just, a lot of it is just naturally human, and you're not going to change that. The next part is your belief set and your culture that influences you, and that defines your natural money temperament. That is your default. That's your comfort zone with money behaviorally. And what I'm saying is everybody has a different one because they have different experiences and a different belief set and a different cultural reference. And maybe they're wired a little differently at the biological level, and that's why you sit there and look at a couple, and you're going, wow, he's out of control with spending, and, you know, she can make a buffalo burp on a nickel. And they're both good people, they're both whatever, but they're very, very different. And what I learned as a financial advisor, particularly after talking with hundreds of clients, where usually one was the default, one was kind of in charge and really enjoyed that stuff, the other person, you had to drag them in. Well, they're not bad people, they just have different money temperaments. The key is identify your money temperament, because that has your default with regard to money. And then realize that once you understand, and I don't care what, let's say you're a spender naturally or a saver naturally, it doesn't matter, but if you're a spender, you need to take steps to understand that and then take proactive steps to get your spending under control. In other words, make spending difficult and saving easy. On the other hand, you can be just as functional as a saver. You know, it's not nice to have six kids and living in a shack someplace down near the river, you know, when you're making $200,000 a year. So that can also be dysfunctional. So in that case, we want to make make it encourage you to spend some money for the right things for the right reason and keep savings in perspective. So that's an example, spender saver. But it could also be one might be risk averse and one might like risk. Or one might be what I call a maximizer, you know, wants to get everything out of the deal. And the other person's kind of the master of the 80% solution. You know, hey, it's okay. So we're all wired a little differently. That's good, but it's also probably the key point of frustration when you're working with couples because they're not wired exactly the same.
Now, one of the things that you talk about, which gets to the issue that where most people have a deficit in, is the knowledge about money. And most people generally, I have found in my experience, I'm sure you have a very limited knowledge of how money works. And what's going to get them to their particular goals. So explain,
right.
And it probably sounds commonsensical, but explain what do you mean in your money behavior system when you say, what is your money knowledge?
When I talk about money knowledge, there are two components. The first is technical money information, money knowledge. Do you know what a checkbook is? Do you know what a mutual fund is? Do you know how your banking system works? That's the stuff you get in your traditional financial planning course or financial literacy course. And that's the default. It's usually activity, you know, how to open a banking account, how to use a credit card. It's usually a product or a service. And that's the concept of financial literacy pretty much in the Western world. Particularly in the United States. So if you take a financial literacy course, they're probably going to tell you a lot of techniques. They're going to teach you about product, but they don't get into the behavioral piece. So that's part of it. The other piece that is critical, when I was in high school, I took my first course in economics and then got into college and then again into the Marine Corps, money was not as complicated. There were not as many choices. There was not as sophisticated. And part of the problem we have today is too much choice, too much information, too complicated. My gosh, the pros don't understand some of the things we're doing. So to assume that you're going to be able to get your head around all this and be as successful is tough unless you're doing something like you're doing. You do this full time. You know, I was a licensed professional. I did it full time, and I still didn't understand everything. So part of the thing when I say money knowledge, you've got to understand, and I don't care how good you are at what you're doing right now, it probably does not translate directly into the financial industry. So I'm a big believer in finding a coach, an accountability coach, or a licensed professional to help you in those areas that you are not that good at. And this is tough for smart people to figure out because they don't like to delegate. They just assume, you know, I'm a great surgeon, but what makes you think you can run a restaurant? I mean, you know, who cares? So that's one half of the knowledge piece. The other piece is how do you process information? There's a term that's called learning modality, how people learn, take in information the way they like to, they're most comfortable with information, and how it sits. Are you a visual person? Are you an auditory learner? Are you a tactile person? Do you like to feel it? Are you a numbers person? Well, all I'm saying is you probably have a preferred way to take in information. When you're working with money, you're working with a professional, make sure you get the information in a way that works best for you. And then if something doesn't make sense, it's presented wrong, the picture doesn't look right, the words don't sound right, the numbers don't look right, stop. Ask questions. Don't be embarrassed or feel that you don't know what's going on. It's your money. It's your program. Make sure it works. And then the last piece is once you go to what it's often called the compliance piece, where you get all the legal stuff, well, nobody's wired to process that stuff. So you've got to understand what you know, but more importantly, what you don't know. And then wrap that up with how do I like to take in information, and don't be afraid to call time out, walk away, come back when you really understand what's happening, particularly for consequential decisions like buying a house, an expensive car, college education, things like that that are going to have an impact on you and your family for not only a couple of months, but probably years into the future, even multi-generational.
And you make a good point, Ted, because me and my wife, we are real estate investors, and so we started, you know, studying and all this kind of stuff, and I read these books, went to these workshops. Finally, I realized, you know what, I'm a kind of guy that has to get in there and get his hands dirty in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally had to say, I just got to do it. I have to make a decision. I know what the technical parts are, all the things in real estate investing, but eventually you have to bite the bullet and do something, you know. And so I knew that I could read but so much, study but so much, but eventually I had to do something. And so that was my money kind of attitude, is that I just got to do something and then learn and go along the way. The other part was, one of the things, if you remember, I mean, you're a little older than I am, but you remember back when they had everybody had pensions, you remember that? And then they got away.
Yeah, back in the last century.
And, yeah, 50 years ago. And they did away with pensions, and they told everybody, guess what, you're going to get a 401k or 403b. But now, Ted, and you and I know, they didn't have the knowledge to understand that stuff. And, you know, I'd like to find somebody, anybody who actually did what they were supposed to do, put in their 10, 5, 20%, whatever, and then retired off of all the money they had in their 401k. Because most people generally, as you said, with their money temperament or money attitude, probably when it got to a certain amount, they started taking some of it or cut back on it or life changes. And so, you know, and they didn't have the knowledge to choose some of these products. And then, as you've already said, the products just exploded. There were so many products and, you know, so many choices, and folks just didn't have the time or the inclination or the knowledge to be able to make those choices. So you make a good real point with the knowledge part. So now you have you have the value, you have the temperament, you have the knowledge. Now the money strategy. Explain to us, you know, having a money strategy. What does that mean in your money behavior system?
Okay. Money strategy, now we get to money strategy, we're getting closer to the traditional financial planning process, which is, where do you want to be 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, or whatever? What are the big items that you want to make happen that are on your value list? But what is the plan to make that happen? Are you going to get a college education? What career are you going to move into? If you've made a decision, you know, was it a good decision? Is it appropriate for you? These are the 30,000 foot view of where you are now, where you want to be in the short term and the long term, and what you think in general terms how you want to get there. So strategy is a concept, if you will. If it's a business, and let me kind of digress for a second. One of the things, and you made up a very good point when you talked about the 401k. I believe today we have to have a significant mindset change on how we look at money from the standpoint that today everyone is self-employed. Everyone. Mm. You have to have the mindset that you are in charge of your own business. It's the business of you, you Inc. And when you move into the strategy, this is where this becomes important. Because we used to always have this employee mindset that somebody's going to take care of me. It's going to be okay. Well, it wasn't a big deal in the post-World War II economy when people had good jobs and they could have a savings account and a house paid for and all the kids lived within walking distance. You had a pension. You had Social Security. You had some life insurance. And you're only going to live to about 65, 72 years old anyhow. Well, it's not like that anymore. So what I tell everybody, the first thing they have to do when they move into the money strategy is have a very honest benchmarking or assessment of where they are financially, emotionally, value-wise, understand how they process information, but also understand their basic money temperament. Then to ensure that their strategy is aligned with how they think and feel about money, their temperament, how they process information, their knowledge, it will move them towards nothing. And then it gets more difficult. How do you make that happen? But I'll tell you, everybody is self-employed. They just don't know it.
So one of the things you mentioned is that your strategy should match your temperament. Explain what you mean by
that. Okay. If we sit down and do an assessment, and you come out, and I've got tools that I use, but let's assume for conversation that, well, I had a conversation with a client a number of years back, and she was doing very well. She lived in Atlanta. She was making about 2.25 a year, and I went through the assessment, and I said, I would consider you a spender. And she got a bit offended. She said, I'm not a spender. I save money. I save $10,000 to $12,000 a year, which is a fortune in her terms. She was self-made, did not come from money. $12,000 in savings was a lot of money, not consciously to her. But I had to look at her and I said, yeah, but you're making $225,000 a year. You're saving $10,000. That means you're spending $230,000. So,
wow.
You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But her mindset and perspective was, I'm on track. I'm doing what they said. I'm maxing out my IRA. I'm maxing out this, that, and the other thing. But in relative perspective to who she is and what she's doing, she was a spender. And that's okay. If the valet at Nordstrom's knows your name, that's fine. Just make sure you've got everything else taken care of before you go to Nordstrom's.
So now you've got all that together, your action plan. Explain what your action plan ends up being in terms of your money behavior system.
Yeah, the action plan is what probably you and I have been doing for years, working with people, working with ourselves, and this is actually going out and putting in play the products and services necessary to get the things that you think are important to you in life. And it may be buying a car in the next couple of years, it may be college planning, emergency savings account, maybe starting a business. These are the grassroots, traditional things that we see in the planning process that says, if I want a $500,000 home someplace in Atlanta, and it's going to cost me this amount of money, and I'm going to need this very down payment, and I want to do it in 5 years, then I can back into it and say that this is what I need to do today to make that happen. This can be a little sobering, and then I go back to the money knowledge piece. Pretty easy when all you had past is a savings account, a checking account, a pension, maybe one mutual fund. It wasn't that complicated. Today, you've got so many choices, so many options, so many ways of accomplishing your action plan. For a lot of people, it's information overload, and instead of doing something, they absolutely shut down and do nothing, which is worse.
And that goes back to the whole issue of, you know, not having that foundational education in high school, let alone college, to be able to do that.
Right.
And in your book, you mentioned it already, and I want to hit that point. You said the rules have changed. You mentioned that you were supposed to study hard, get a good education, get a good job, retire with a pension. Those rules have changed. Explain what you mean by
you got
that.
It.
I think you've alluded to some of
the rules. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, let's go back to, you know, it seems like, the last century, which was January 2020, where we had literally full employment, incredible opportunities, historic highs in the stock market. You could set your own tone as to where you worked and what you wanted to do. Life was pretty good, and it changed in an instant. Matter of fact, we got hit in the face by a black swan. And a black swan is an unanticipated, unknown, consequential event that devastates everything, and in hindsight, it looks like it was absolutely predictable. Well, that's what we're going through right now. What we're finding today is we've moved from, it's called structural transformation in economics terms, that we've gone from a post-World War manufacturing economy to a international economy, to a distribution economy, a digital economy, and an information economy, and we're ready to do it again. We come out of the pandemic, the economy that we're going to see in the next 18 months is going to be different than the one we had in January. But the point I'm making is it moves incredibly quick. You have to understand that you being self-employed, that you're at the mercy of very rapidly moving events that you have no control over. A virus on the other side of the world, a change in technology, a piece of software, somebody who is not as educated as you that can come in and bump you out at a third the price because the job structure is changing. So what I'm trying to get people to understand is in today's world, it's moving at warp speed. It's moving at the speed of life. Stocks are traded in milliseconds. Something could happen in the morning that could have an incredible impact on your livelihood, and you don't even have time to react. So we've got a different way of doing things, and I personally believe that days are over with when you walk in and have a laminated copy of your degree, and that's going to be a ticket to get someplace. It doesn't work that way anymore. And here's a word that's tough for some people to swallow. It's called fair. It's not fair. It's reality. Fair is having the opportunity to fix it, to be able to survive and thrive, and not have impediments turn up against you. But you have to realize that our economy is moving so quickly that the degree you had a year and a half ago may be obsolete today. So what it comes down to is part of your mindset and part of your plan is continual self-improvement, investing in you, the business of you, and that's human capital. Are your skills current? Are you in a discipline that there's still a market for? Are you prepared to get up and rework your business so you can be competitive? That's the new reality, and it takes work, and it's emotionally trying.
And I've been sharing, and this has been my mantra ever, during this pandemic, and that when people talk about some of the things they want to do in life, and if you don't come out of this pandemic without some more knowledge, a new skill, or a side hustle, it's not that you don't have time, you just lack discipline. If that makes sense.
Boy, you hit it right on the head.
People out there, if I could have, would have, should. Well, now you're sheltered at home. You have a whole lot of time. How much can you binge watch on Hulu or Netflix? Okay, after a while,
exactly.
I've been doing a lot of reading, and which is one of my loves. I've got over 1,000 books. And I just love to read, so I've been kind of just doing that. And of course, I'm getting into my side hustle, which of course is this podcast and some other things I'm trying to do. With the show I had a syndicated show about 20 years ago, and I'm bringing it back up. But the point is that if you don't come out of this pandemic with something of value, then it's your discipline, and that's something that you have to focus on. Now, one of the things that you do, your book is very easy to read, and you use the example of going to the mall. Explain how that is used in the book to help explain behavior.
Well, when I looked at the need, I'm on a mission to change the world. I want to change how we think and feel about money, the whole construct of what financial literacy means, to put behavior at the front of all of this. And to do that, I could have written a book that was very technical, traditional neuroeconomics and bioeconomics, and to be very honest, nobody would have read it, nobody would have cared, it wouldn't have an impact. I want to sit down. The stuff that I write about is not about money. I write about money, but it's not money. It's about leadership. I write about personal leadership, that it's your responsibility to take care of yourself with regard to money, to know what it is, know where you want to go, and how to manage it. It's broader leadership to take care of the people around you that you care about and care about you, and then the organizations you're in to have the right mindset with regard to money. So money, first and foremost, is leadership. So when we understand where we're going with money, I want this to be bottom up. I want people to understand that money is not difficult if you start with understanding yourself. We do it in everything else. Before you get a driver's license, we look at your behavior. Before you can do almost anything else I can think of, we factor in your behavior. But we don't do it with money. We need to have a seismic shift in the discussion about financial literacy. And we need to get around teaching people about how to compute present and future value and make them understand that it's about managing what's between the ears and not what's in the wallet. That's what we have to do, and it needs to be bottom up. So I'm passionate about this. If you want to save money, I'm going to give everybody a tip right now. You read the book. It's an easy read, and it was designed to be that way. There's no math, no graphs, no numbers, anything along that line. And it's based on going to the mall, because the mall is ubiquitous. There's one everywhere. Everybody has been to the mall. The mall is designed as a spending experience. It attacks our senses. It attacks our psyche. It attacks our emotions. And as soon as we think we're going to the mall, we're primed to spend. So I have vignettes in there that I think are really a lot of fun and easy to grasp about you going on a spending trip through a course of probably a month or so and a different experiences, but it forces you in a position to say, wait a minute, why did I do this? When I went with a friend and they were picking out some clothing, I had no intention to buy clothing, but I decided to go to the store with them. In the process of being there, I just happened to spend an extra $200 on stuff I didn't need, and I don't know why. You know, why do you go into the supermarket and fill your, you know, to buy milk and bread, but fill your cart with all kinds of stuff and forget your milk and bread? Because we're human, and we're always going to do human things with money. So what I try to do with the story of the mall is, number one, everybody's been there. We've all done that, and we've all done stupid things with money. My wife, fortunately, keeps a list of all my stuff. And what we're trying to do is make people understand that once you understand who you are, your relationship with money, it becomes manageable because you're managing the behavior. And before you head to the mall, you take a copy of my book, you throw it on the seat next to you if you're driving, and you just look at it or take it with you into the mall, I guarantee you'll save money.
And that's an important thing. And understanding your money temperament and the things that you value and the things that you like to do and like to spend money on, and you make it and the mall experience, I guess, is a great example of that. And I think that, you know, you hit something because retailers, you know, you're talking about money behavior. Retailers understand our shopping behavior. And so they know,
yes,
like in Walmart, why do they put the eggs and the bread on different sides of the building? Why? So you can walk all
exactly
through the place. So they understand,
oh, yeah,
they understand consumer behavior better, of course, better than we do. And we just, well, I'm walking through all these aisles, and why? Why ain't the bread and all this stuff, that the staples, the eggs and butter and all together? You go into a store and they try to upsell you. They understand, and they're very good at it. And that's why these companies are very successful, like Walmart and Amazon. I mean, think about Amazon. For me, Amazon is like crack, okay?
Exactly.
And let me tell you why. Because I love books. The worst thing they could have done is have a Kindle that you could download a book. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that, you know, I have to really just put things in my shopping cart. Okay, I'm not going to buy that. You know, because if you see a book that you like or anything else, I'm just using that as an example, and you can get it within 30 seconds, how cool is that? Imagine how many folks would be broke if they could download some shoes or dress, but now they have Prime delivery. You get stuff in 2 days. So it's making, they understand the psychology, and we're going into the retail, going into the environment, ill-equipped to deal with the offense. The offense they're coming at us because they understand our behavior and we don't. So you're making a great example of the behavior that we need to learn ourselves about what motivates and moves us, so we can be on the defensive and not get caught up into it. So for me, it would be, okay, I see a book I like, I'm going to put it in my shopping cart. I may not get it. And then I finally decide not to get it and that kind of thing. So that's important.
Yeah.
So you're trying to change the world. What are you doing? How are you doing that? In addition to the book, what other vehicles, website are you using to kind of get the word?
I have my website, which is tedmcclyman.com or discoveryourmoneytemperament.com. They go to the same place. And that there you can learn more about me and the concepts behind the book. I'm also the director of behavioral finance at dreamsmartacademy.com. And there we're making a concerted effort to reach out and train people about these behavioral concepts. We're working on building a charter school out in Tempe, Arizona, based on a lot of these concepts. And I will talk to anybody that stands still long enough to hear part of what I'm passionate about, to make people understand that what we're doing with money is not working. And because of the reality of modern life, it's really destructive. And I go back to J. Alexander Martin, who was the founder of Google. I co-authored a book with him because he read my first book and said, we need to get together. He squandered about $8 million over 10 years just in lifestyle decisions because nobody told him any different. He thought he was supposed to do that. He's fortunate. He recovered. He's probably one of the most successful businessmen in the United States today. He's got an empire. But I'll tell you, he was very close to losing it all just because of the spending behavior. And he finally realized it after we worked together and he wrote a book explaining his journey and talking about how to identify his temperament, get his spending in control, and all of that carries into the new book, which is Discovering the Money Temperament.
So in that book, Money Makes Me Crazy, How I Squandered Millions of Dollars Building the FUBU Empire, is it a continuation of your book, or was that before your book? Which one came first?
I wrote a book that is very similar to the one that's out right now, that was a book I wrote for my clients primarily. And that was the one that Jay got a hold of, and we started talking, and I built on those concepts, where most of the concepts that we're talking about here. And then last year, give you an example. I had done a podcast. I was sitting in a coffee shop talking to the guy that was doing the interview, and a guy came over and tapped me on the shoulder. He said, "You don't know who I am, but I want to shake your hand. I want to say thank you." And he's a very successful businessman from Kenya, who is now a nationalized American citizen. He went from literally having nothing in his pocket. He's now worth a couple million dollars and has a very large publishing empire. And he said, "Ted, I read your first book. It made such a – you changed my life because I put in place the things you talk about, and you were the first one to say it's okay to have my own feelings about money, but put in play a strategy that works for me, not somebody else, not the cookie-cutter approach. It has to be one size fits you," and that's what he did. Well, he grabbed me and he said, "We need to republish this book," and he's now my publisher.
Wow. Wow. You never know how you're going to have that impact in terms of for J. Alexander Martin to, I think in 25 years he just threw away $8 million. I mean, $50,000 on watches and cars and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, it was crazy!
So I guess, you know, and I'm assuming he's doing much better now. And the assumption is that he had the money to blow, pretty much, because he didn't get, you know.
Now, this was back in the 80s, before smartphones and a few things like that. And he did, I mean, he grew up a very nice lifestyle in Queens. His mom and dad were doing well, but he wanted to do some things that were a little different. But he got wrapped in the belief set and the culture set he should do with his money, which was spend $5,000 to $8,000 a week going out to clubs, having big cars, big houses and stuff, not worrying about anything else. It was all about conspicuous consumption. A friend of mine gave him a copy of my first book. He was a guy was a client, and he read it. He gave me a call and said, "We need to talk." And after basically talking with him and, you know, a little coaching and consulting, I said, "Jay, we need to sit down and write a book. And I want to use your experience to explain how money works." And he graciously did that. We spent a couple of years on the road doing book reviews and things like that. He is a great guy. And we're going to re-release that book, I think, later in the year.
Because one of the things I think the assumption was, he gives a story in his book about how he was doing a conference, I want to say in Las Vegas somewhere, and he was out in front of all these guys, and he's seeing them all in suits, but you couldn't tell who had $1 billion or who had $100 million. They were all kind of the same.
Yep.
And obviously he was relating to himself how far he had come, because obviously he would been over the top in the gold jewelry and all that and the fancy stuff.
Right.
So it makes a good example. The assumption is that folks, and I'm sure you found that with some of your clients, that the folks who have been very successful in a business know a lot how to manage their money. You would think a gentleman like Jay, you know, Alexander Martin, knows a lot about how to manage money. And because, you know, he was very good at, I guess, designing clothes and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a misnomer, isn't it? That the folks who are wealthy, that they really know how to manage money, when it's really that they knew how to run their business and how to be successful with a product or whatever. And that kind of makes them think they could do other stuff, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's a great insight. And I'll look at entertainers and athletes. There's a difference between having money and having wealth. There are a lot of people with money, not a lot of people with wealth. In the last 2 or 3 years, how many professional athletes who were making hundreds of millions of dollars are now bankrupt? How many people have made some really, really stupid decisions? So that's the difference between not understanding who you are and having money, as opposed to understanding who you are and having wealth. Warren Buffett is a guy that has wealth because he understands who he is. He drives a 10-year-old car. He's still in the house he's been in for 40 years, and he's worth billions and billions of dollars. So, and this is a cultural thing. Our culture puts a high value on money and the trappings. It does not put a high value on wealth because wealth is boring. Okay? And you're never going to get a reality TV show, you know, if you're just sitting there looking at your investments grow and your money market account being very boring, just chugging along. It's the emotions of money that we like to watch and emulate. There's been a couple of good studies that back to 2008, one of the reasons for the real estate crash was reality TV, because for the first time people were watching other folks that they thought were just like them flipping houses. And my gosh, on a half-hour TV show, it looks so easy to make $1 million or to make $100,000 over 30 days. They don't show you all the people that went bankrupt. They don't show you how hard it is to flip houses. They don't tell you how hard it is to make it happen. And we're still into that to some degree. The whole celebrity culture is more into money than it is wealth.
And you're so right. You know, you watch some of these shows and you see like the reality television and stuff like that. You see these supposedly regular people that are really successful having problems. Like, hey, you're worth $10 to $20, $30 million. What are you fighting about? You know what I mean? You know. And then, like you said, with some of the flipping shows and stuff like that, you know, they don't understand that. Yes, you could do that. There is some risk. But there is rewards, and you just have to understand the risk-reward part of that. In closing, what would you advise somebody today and trying to get a grasp on where they are right now? Obviously, during this pandemic, they may have more time to read. And see, here's my concern also, Ted, is that, you know, folks are not reading as much as anymore. And, no. You know, so you could write a book, and, you know, it's going to take you 4 or 5 hours to write it, but you know, you could binge watch how many episodes of Tiger King or whatever it is they're watching these days.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. That's a whole other question. But anyway, so how do you get your message out outside of the books? What, I know you got a website. You have a YouTube.
Yeah, website.
People watch stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've got a YouTube channel. If you go to my TedMcClyman.com. There's a tab in there that's about me. It shows all my social media. Basically, anything with Ted McClyman, I'm the only one in the country you're going to find me. I've got a YouTube channel with a number of videos that talk a lot about these concepts. Obviously, the book. I'll tell you, if you're sitting home right now and you don't know where you're going to finally get let out, reading this book, you could. It's not a hard read. It really isn't. I also have a free course on my site. If you go to TedMcClyman.com, there's a free course with an introduction to the concepts I write about. I believe that money is not rocket science. It is neuroscience. It's behavior. But it's just understanding some very simple concepts and applying them to your daily life as a business owner.
Now,
you're wired biology not to work well with money.
This quick scan money temperament assessment, is that what's on your website, or is that something they have to get personally from you?
That's something you have to get that personally through me, that should be out. We're redoing that tool. But if anybody wants to talk about that, they can send me an email or whatever, and I'd be glad to get online and talk about this. Or even in your case, if you want to do something in Atlanta, I'm available. I mean, I'm not that far away. This is important. People need to understand this. And if you're serious about coming out of I did a seminar just last week online for the folks in Texas called Discover Your Money Temperament, Thriving After QB19. And what I said there is you have to reset. You have to benchmark. Now is the time to truly define what are your unifying values. What's important about money to you? How do you think and feel about money and temperament? Inventory your basic knowledge. Is it accurate? Is it relevant? Is it dated? Is it something you can handle? I mean, if you're dealing in bitcoins and you don't know how to work a checking account, you probably need to have a talk with somebody. Then do you have a strategy? I'm not even saying a plan. You have a strategy. And it should be something a little deeper than I want to go on a vacation this summer. Then
I think a lot of folks, their strategy is hit the lottery. That's what they're all about.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's well, that's only assuming if your collection of Elvis plates are already up to date, you know? So, you know, what can I say? It's we make this too hard, and that's why I say this is not a book about money. It's about you and your behavior, and why when you go to the mall, you spend money. Why when you go to a car dealership, you end up with more car than you need. Why you seem to be fixated on why you've got to dress a certain way or act a certain way, or just the opposite. You know, there's some people out there that were in some clothes they had in high school. I'm not judging. I'm just saying there's a reason you're doing that, and you need to get your head around it. And if you're in a relationship, you need to get the people in that relationship with you that care about you and care about them to sit down and have this discussion. And then be brutally honest.
Well, Ted, thank you so much for being on Your Personal Finance. Like I said, this is so new to my frame of reference because, like I said, I've been around finances for 30, 40 years. And I've never had anybody explain or even, just get into the conversation about the money, about your money behavior. So I thank you so much for your efforts. And they can find you on TedMcClyman.com access your YouTube and all the other tools that you have. Thank you so much, Ted, for being on Your Personal Finance.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care now. All right.
Bye.
So, wow, that's, that is a lot. I mean, and we're going to have him back to talk about some specific stuff when we get on the other side of this pandemic, because a lot of people, an example I gave, I always try to put things in a reference of something I already know. And, you know, on television, you see all these different companies that have, diet programs. What is it? They don't come to mind, but all these different programs, Weight Watchers and all these other different programs, and trying to get you to lose weight, and it's the psychology behind it, that you have to understand your relationship, with money, and of course if you're dieting, you have to understand your relationship with food, because in any diet, I don't care what you're talking about. Any diet, you are going to have to deal with that you're going to feel hungry sometimes. And I think for most people, based on how they feel about that, will determine how they deal with, oh, I'm hungry now. What do I do? Did I go get a ding-dong, which sometimes I do, or you get an apple, or you drink some water, because I've been told by my doctor that sometimes when you think you're hungry, you're actually thirsty. And so you have to understand that. And I think that the ones that are successful in dieting understand what motivates them, what are their triggers. And then when it comes to money, as Ted was sharing, you got to understand your background, how you grew up. Did you grow up very poor and didn't have a lot? Was always scarcity, or you grew up with a lot of money and you don't have any respect for money. So I just think that he's doing a great work, and I don't think folks give a lot of credence to understand behavior, because the retailers spend a lot of money understanding consumer behavior. In other words, why people do what they do. And that's why you see ads on television, for the programs you're watching, or you see ads on the internet, or if you're scrolling your social media, you see things, and Facebook is tremendously, extremely good at this kind of stuff. They understand, they have all kinds of data in terms of the things that you've clicked through. So understanding your money behavior is very, very important. And I know it's given me a pause for thought about, my money behavior and the things that I can change in order to be, more successful moving forward. With a guy like J. Alexander Martin, the co-founder of FUBU, you probably have never heard of him, but of course he's from Queens, New York, all right, native New Yorker, shout out to them, but that he can go through $8 million in 25 years and still come out on the other side doing very, very well, and finds this book, to help him understand how he could be more successful with money. I think we all can take some pause for that. Well, thank you so much for being a part of Your Personal Finance, and we'll be back again with another broadcast on Friday, and enjoy the podcast.